For those of you that are new here this afternoon, the resources that are out on the table right in the back are for you to take, assuming that you will use them. And please pick them up very quickly afterwards, as we'll be leaving soon after this is over, hopefully to make it home before the snow. But we shall see. So we finished up with talking about giving and ended the giving part talking about what we called the simplicity factor. And so we want to continue that idea as we think about lifestyle perspectives. And when we look at life, what should our lifestyle look like? Does God have a prescribed lifestyle for His children? Should we all be exactly alike? How much gap should there be in who we are as people? And so we could talk about this for a long time, but let's think about our lifestyle being governed by the simplicity factor. So this New Testament word simplicity, having the idea of single-hearted devotion, simple living aligns perfectly with one who is single-heartedly wanting to do the Master's will. Simple living is a nuisance to those devoted to serving self because it hinders their desires and cramps their lifestyle. So I believe our spending is a testimony of our values. I think you could also take this and swing too far one way or the other way. God gives us provision, and I think He finds joy in seeing us delight in His provision. Our consumptive nature, though, would always want us to go farther probably than what we should. And so I think we should find joy in what God has provided, but I do think we, as a people, especially living in a land of plenty, the concept of simple living needs to be in front of us probably more than the idea of enjoying all the good things God has given us. A life of joyful simplicity, 2 Corinthians 1:12. For our rejoicing is this, the testimony of our conscience, that in simplicity and godly sincerity, not with fleshly wisdom, but by the grace of God, we have had our conversation, that word there is lifestyle, we've had our lifestyle in the world, and more abundantly toward you. So simplicity brings rejoicing and a clear conscience. Simplicity denies fleshly wisdom, so you may decide to live simply, and it looks odd to the world. Simplicity is powered by the grace of God. Simplicity shows up in a lifestyle of godly sincerity. So our lifestyle should say something about our sincerity. And simplicity impacts the world and the brotherhood. So this single-hearted simplicity creates a testimony. It lays aside self and lives for God's greater cause. Simplicity motivates simple living, not the other way around. So what we're saying here is single-minded devotion to Christ, I believe, leads us towards simple living. There's only one thing to live for, right? That's pretty simple. There is joy and thanksgiving in this kind of simple living, and this kind of simple living is Word of God directed and Spirit led. And so the obvious here is that as we are focused on living for Christ and we have that simple, single-hearted devotion, there are things that we're just going to say no to in life to enhance that relationship, to serve Him better, to be more available to do His will. And so that's, I believe, the connection here between simplicity and simple living. Simple living in an attempt to mimic simplicity is man-made, law-based bondage. So if we get the motivation and the outward mixed up here, if we're externally putting pressure on ourselves or each other, or have some kind of external code by which we are all going to live by, I believe that is going to come across as a self-made, man-made bondage. It attempts to impress God and others with my goodness, It's an outer form without the inner motivation of love. I believe this kind of simple living lacks joy and thanksgiving because it's miserly, stingy, and self-focused. It's me mastering my stuff according to my word instead of stewarding God's resources according to His word. Now, this idea of exchange commitments is interesting to think about. Money is called a medium of exchange. Okay, if I would offer to give you $100, you know, maybe I could get something from you. You have a bike sitting out beside the road. Okay, the assumption is that if it's for sale, the exchange is going to be money for the thing. And so money is called a medium of exchange. And so every time we spend money, what we're really saying is, I am willing to give this amount of money for this thing. It's an exchange. So every time we spend money, we are making this exchange commitment. Jesus used this word exchange, for what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and my words, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed. So do you know anyone who has made this terrible exchange? Being ashamed of the Master and failing to heed His words and having Him be ashamed of us is a sobering thought, that we would exchange something else for that relationship with our Master, in our Master-servant relationship. So we could put lots of things in the blank here. I'm willing to give $50,000 for a vehicle. I'm willing to give $921 for 25 years and pay $276,000 for a $150,000 house, like we saw in that mortgage example. I'm willing to pay 18% credit card interest on restaurant meals, groceries, and propane that was already consumed last month. So every time that we're spending money, borrowing money, paying interest, whatever that is, we are making an exchange commitment. So what has your story been? Probably more important than that question is, what do you want your story to be when you stand before the Master? Someone didn't like all the stuff up here. But down here we had, when the Master returns, there's going to be reward or reprimand. And so when we stand before Him, what do we want our story to be? He's going to be interested in the things that we exchange. He's going to be interested in this exchange commitment. Are you willing to exchange simple living on earth to obtain treasure in heaven? I believe that's the real question here. And it's interesting that we can use things as simple and as mundane and earthly and temporal as money to gain heavenly, eternal, lasting treasure. Now, thinking about stewardship attitudes, this is going back now to the original slide where we talked about the steward and the owner attitude. And I should clarify, the owner attitude, it might be better defined as the selfish owner, okay? Because we all do believe in ownership to some degree. You don't just go out here and jump in whichever vehicle you want and take it home and use it for the week and come back and then next week you get in a different vehicle. Okay, we believe in that you have your stuff and I have my stuff. So this selfish ownership mentality is that maybe the emphasis should be on selfish ownership as compared to being a steward as God has defined it. So contentment falls logically in line with the steward attitude. And the verse from 1 Timothy, godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world, and it's certain we're going to carry nothing out. But having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. So we all came the same way. We're all going to leave the same way. And we all believe it's God's while we're here. But somehow we have this this idea that we're really concerned whose hands it's in. You know, it's all God's, but we're really concerned that it's in His hand and not my hand, or it's in His hand and not that His hand. And so we need to be careful about that. Covetousness, Paul says, let it not be named among you as becometh saints. In Hebrews it says, let your conversation be without covetousness. I believe it's also there in Ephesians where Paul says covetousness is idolatry. And so covetousness is a serious, selfish ownership type of sin. Now, some definition here. Contentment recognizes that everything he holds has been provided by the gracious hand of God and holds his material resources with an open hand. The covetous person sees his resources as a product of his hand, and he holds them with a tight grip. This is the part of contentment that I struggle with. Contentment provides the environment in which relationships take precedence over doing things and acquiring things. And so the covetous side here is that covetousness puts the acquisition of things, or we could say maybe the accomplishment of things, ahead of relationships, making it a common root cause of conflicts related to finances. So maybe it's a man problem, maybe it's just my problem, but I find myself saying, you know, I don't say it, but it's what comes out, you know, get out of my way, I got a lot to do. You're getting in the way of what I have on my agenda. And so contentment and covetousness, I believe, works its way into our lifestyle as an attitude that is beyond just finances, and there's this relational aspect as well. Contentment is not laziness. In other words, we're not promoting laziness here. We are to work and to provide and to be productive, and so we cannot equate and say contentment is laziness. That's not what we're saying. On the other side, covetousness is driven by the endless desire to have just a little bit more for self. Probably the most practical, down-to-earth, everyday attitude that we deal with, and maybe if we don't deal with it, we try to deal with it in our children, and that is thanksgiving or complaining. We're commanded to give thanks, in everything give thanks, and then in Ephesians, giving thanks always for all things. It's interesting. On the complaining side here, we have the passage in Exodus 16, how the children of Israel murmured and complained. And then we have Paul's commentary about that in 1 Corinthians 10. And so he says, the whole congregation, or Exodus says, the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Okay, they were complaining. They were specifically complaining about God's provision, which was manna. I'm not sure what that would equate to in our life here, if it'd be like eating cornflakes for 40 years or not. But the provision, it was God's provision, and it wasn't enough for them, and I highly doubt that those of us here would think it's enough for us either. So we probably shouldn't be too hard on the Israelites here. But Paul says in 1 Corinthians, neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now, our definition here, thanksgiving is a logical response of a content steward because he finds joy in what God has provided. Don't ever fool yourself into thinking that once I hit my savings goal line, once I have more, once my net worth is so much, then I'm going to turn into a thankful person. Okay? Thanksgiving is possible right here, right now, with whatever you have. Just as complaining is, I suppose. Yeah, you understand that. Complaining is a logical response of a covetous owner because he is never satisfied with the amount or the quality of his things. So those of us who think we don't have much and, you know, if we just have a little bit more, we'd be more thankful and life would be better and all of that. Inevitably, what happens to that kind of person when they move up a notch or whatever they do, they get to that place where they do have more, then all of a sudden it's not the amount of things that they have. They get obsessed with the quality or just all of the nuances of this product. And all of a sudden they don't just need a crossbow. They need a certain kind of crossbow. They don't need a vehicle to get from point A to point B. They need to make certain statements as they go from point A to point B in their certain kind of vehicle. And so, be a thankful person. I believe this is where most of us find our most pressing homework assignment. This is where it gets very practical, where we catch ourselves by what we say in everyday circumstances. We're revealing what we believe about God's provision, and we need to be very careful about that. So some spending vocabulary. What does your spending say about you? So expectations. So as a school teacher hauling students in my vehicle, a lot of them were accustomed to power doors, power seats, power windows. And so I say these were poor, deprived children who have come to expect that vehicles should enhance their comfort, their pleasure, and their ease. I remember one time there was a little whippersnapper who was getting very frustrated, actually pretty mad, because he couldn't figure out how to manually adjust the seat that he was in, and it didn't suit his fancy. And so he went on to describe, you know, what their vehicle is like, and I realized that the rest of the students were kind of in his league too. They had come to expect that you would get in a vehicle and the seat should conform to your image, and it should make sure that you are comfortable. And you know, if it's not heated seats, it's for sure self-adjusting seats or program seats where, you know, you hit your program and you get it the way you want it to be. Okay? I think we're talking about entitlement now. They've come to the place where they believe that life should conform to me, or at least my vehicle seat. Embezzlement is when a manager, a trustee, or a steward uses resources for his own benefit against the master's direction or will. So a biblical example here, Achan took what God had clearly said should be destroyed. Okay, God had defined what should be done with his resources in Jericho. Achan took and did as a trustee or manager what he should not have done with God's resources. This would be like the deacon just keeping some of the church offering for himself. Okay, a deacon is a good illustration of a steward, a manager, a trustee. He's entrusted with the funds of the church, and trust is a part of that. So the question for us here, have you ever knowingly used God's resources for your own benefit outside of His will? Have you ever embezzled God's funds? The next word is enough. The ability to say, I have enough, will free you from the tyranny of more. The power of enough is a very effective tool used by self-controlled and spirit-led saints. And so this is where something as practical as a budget can help you say, set and determine what is enough. And so the ability to say enough, I have enough, and then not complain about what you don't have is a very important E word. And then exchange, we've been talking about that. So who calls the shots in your spending? Paul says, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. So when you think about it, why do you think you need the things that you do? Whether we like it or not, we all put pressure on each other. And we all look around at each other. And we all think that we at least deserve, you know, the same level as everyone else, or, you know, if we're honest, we deserve just a little bit more than everyone else because, you know, we work a little harder and we're a little more frugal and we're a little better manager. And that is just the reality of who we are as people. Paul says we're not wise to compare. So we need to be willing to stand against social and cultural pressure. Because your friends have it does not make it a need for you. So that it's comparison based here. Well, they have it, and you know, everybody else at church has it, so, well, then it must be a need, right? No. Because I can afford it does not really justify a purchase. This is a real sticky one. Because you can afford something does not mean that it's right for you to get it. And so I think this is a challenge, a great challenge for those who have the ability to just keep going, go up and up and up and increase their lifestyle. And it creeps up on people and they don't stop to think about what they're actually doing. Because I can afford it does not really justify a purchase. Think about it this way. If I went out and bought a $70,000 vehicle, would you say that's right or wrong for me? Well, I can answer that. It's wrong. Okay. Why is it wrong? Because I can't afford it. Okay. Now, if someone in our church who's making $150,000 a year, they go out and buy a $70,000 vehicle, is it right or wrong for them? See, we didn't change the situation at all. We just changed their ability. Okay, so that's what the focus is here. Because I can afford it does not really justify a purchase. And that applies to smaller things than $70,000 vehicles. It applies to all of us in our daily decision making. So do your lifestyle choices bless the brotherhood or create pressure for others to keep up? This idea of social classifying where we kind of have these levels of people in our social sphere. I'm going to skip this, but if you want a good book to read, The Worst Financial Mistakes in the Bible by Chuck Bentley is an excellent resource. It'd be great to get for a devotional. He hits on these stewardship attitudes in a very, very potent sort of way. Conclusions about lifestyle. I believe we're back to the temperance and the excess sides of things here. A lifestyle, the steward lives a lifestyle of restraint, self-control, trusting the Lord and living within one's means. Thrift and good discipline is evident in times of abundance because the steward is compelled by the simplicity factor toward a single-hearted devotion to Christ that is evident not only in word, but also in lifestyle. When we find ourselves in a place of excess, we tend to live a lifestyle of indulgence and a lack of self-restraint in which consumption, leisure, and entertainment become the most important. Thrift, self-discipline, and restraint are thrown to the wind in favor of funding our own desires. There's an interesting prayer towards the end of Proverbs, and this is, interestingly enough, the only prayer recorded in Proverbs. Two things have I required of thee, deny me not them before I die. Remove from me vanity and lies, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my Lord God in vain. So the writer of Proverbs here, it seems like he has this, he sees that there's danger in the extremes. Okay? If I would be in poverty, then I would steal and I would do things that I shouldn't otherwise do. If I'm rich and in a place of having too much, I might be full and deny God. And so I think this prayer would be very good for us to add to the end of the Lord's Prayer. We can say the Lord's Prayer on automatic without even thinking about what we're saying. So if you want to change it up, you say the Lord's Prayer and then add this to the end yet. And I think it would do all of us good to have this as part of our vocabulary, part of our stewardship vocabulary. There's a specific warning about excess. So when the people of Israel, when the children of Israel were going to go into the land, Moses, or God giving direction to Moses, tells the people to beware when they come to that place of excess, when they come to that place of blessing, when they all of a sudden have more than what they needed. And the beware is, beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God. That's the danger that we live in, because we do live in a land of plenty. We live in a land where there is excess. And so we need to be very careful about taking on this temperance, attitude of temperance, and rather than living in a lifestyle of excess. All right, budgeting and financial planning. For some reason, this always ends up as the last thing, and it always ends up as the afternoon topic, so everyone falls asleep on budgeting and financial planning. I am not going to go through nearly everything because I have way too much, so we're going to just hit some of the high points, and I'll be skipping through. I do have one printout of all my notes, which basically is everything that I'm saying. I'll leave that behind and email the rest of my notes so you can share them around. Ron Blue says, financial planning is allocating limited income to unlimited spending opportunities. So if you think about when you go to Walmart or you go to Lowe's or wherever you go and do your shopping, your spending possibilities are endless. But there is a limiting factor, and that is your earning. Now, if any of you have unlimited income, I would like to talk to you afterwards. We could stay for a conversation about that. I want to get to know you a little better. So, assuming that's not your case, which, okay, none of us are in that place, then financial planning is essential. Okay, you're going to need to allocate your limited income to the unlimited spending possibilities. What you're doing with a financial plan is you're literally prioritizing values. You're saying what you value. You're saying what you're willing to exchange your money to get. We're going to go over some of the major categories. The housing category in a budget is usually the largest expense for most families. The commitments in this category create a challenge in many family budgets. And so a mortgage creates that long-term commitment. If you have that 25-year mortgage, you're out till 2044. Renting provides less commitment and more flexibility. So there's a rough rule of thumb that if you're going to be in a house less than 5 years, it may make more sense to rent than to purchase and resell within that first 5 years. Now, the other thing is, if you're going to put any kind of sweat equity or labor into it and increase the value of the home, you may actually be wanting to turn it over faster than that for those reasons. So that's not a complete guide there. Choose to lose, you are going to either lose your rent payment or your interest payment unless you're able to go and pay cash for a house. Some advice for young people: look for value-added housing options, something where you can invest sweat equity, fix it up. Don't expect to start where your parents leave off. And I think for young people, this is very important. Your parents spend a lifetime accumulating what they have, and it's unreasonable to think that you're just going to move into the exact same kind of house as you moved out of. It's an unreasonable expectation. On the other hand, those of us in the, when we get to that place where we have children starting out, I think we need to not enable them or give them the idea that, well, they ought to be where we're at. Allow them to start low and work up. Look down the road. A lot of times in housing, young couples can get into the mistake of just looking at the payment. So when someone goes for a mortgage, usually they're laser focused on, can I afford this monthly payment? And that is an inadequate view of the mortgage. What is the total interest? What is the total term length? What is the total picture of commitment that we're making? A few debt benchmarks. Housing costs should be less than 33% of monthly income. So Not more than one-third of your budget should be going to housing. That would be the mortgage, the real estate taxes, and the insurance. This is a highly debated percentage here. Our loans department says we have frugal people that are spending 45 or 50% of their income on housing. I can guarantee you that they're not living in Bradford. They're living in some little niche farming community where they're pretty much eating off the land and they're doing nothing else. They're just living subsistently. They're making their, they claim they can make $20,000 and make significant mortgage payments and still raise their 10 children. I don't know how that works, but it works in some communities yet because our loans department says it does happen. So for you, I would say 33% or less, depending on your risk tolerance here. 20% down payment. This changed when the world changed. When back in 08, the banks were giving out too much money. They were financing way much more than they should have. The housing market sagged for a long time. The reason for your 20% down payment is if the market softens, you have that 20% cushion. So we're